Hey everybody, and welcome back to another edition of the Open Forum podcast. Today we have with us Kim Staton, an award-winning film director, having started with Films for Change, a way to host, promote, and distribute documentaries the globe over. Today we're going to be discussing the curious case of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, and the documentary that he has made, The Trustful, Julian Assange, and the implications that this has for press freedoms, global freedom of speech, and democracy at large. Kim has kindly given us permission to share the trailer for Trustful, so I'm going to first play a couple of minutes of that and then throw it over to him to introduce himself. Enjoy, and then Kim, take a moment to introduce yourself.
This is generally the view of people, though we don't know much about Assange. Well, you should know, because whether you know it or not, he is fighting for you.
For your courage and leadership and tenacity in journalism and publishing.
Since 2010, Assange has been held in progressively narrower, darker, colder, and crueler spaces.
He has been detained since the 7th of December 2010 in one form or another.
And we are now here. After years of imprisonment.
WikiLeaks is a non-state hostile intelligence service.
I think the man is a high-tech terrorist.
A high-tech terrorist.
A traitor, a treasonist.
He has to answer for what he has done.
Assange faces up to 175 years in prison for publishing classified documents exposing U.S. war crimes.
The U.S. government narrative about Julian is a complete fraud. It is a complete fraud from A to Z.
Julian took on the most powerful countries in the world, basically all of them.
We now have confirmed that there were plans to kidnap Julian here in the center of London, or even assassinate him.
No one who instigated that illegal and immoral war has been brought to justice. But the great truth teller sits behind bars.
If wars can be started by lies, peace can be started by truth.
Julian Assange is a hero.
What if everything we thought we knew about somebody was a lie? Would we be willing to go on a new journey of understanding? This is a story of deception, lies, bravery, and a man who risked everything to bring the truth to light.
Mr. Assange shows all the symptoms that are typical for a person that has been exposed to psychological torture over a prolonged period of time.
He looked at me intensely and said, "I hate to say this." He then hesitated, visibly troubled and searching for words. And then he finally said, "Please, save my life."
May future generations have the ability to speak without restraint. May our children and their children know truth and have access to information that leads to justice. Wherever Julian goes, free speech goes with him.
If there is a bird that is about to take flight, stretch her wings and rule the skies, may it be a peace dove and no longer a bald eagle.
If you think Assange is a traitor, he's a rapist, he's a narcissist, he's a hacker, I don't blame you, because you have been deceived. And if you think you've not been deceived, that's normal, because otherwise it wouldn't be deception.
Thanks for having me. Where shall I start? Well, you know, in 2010, I was watching the nightly news in the living room, and I saw this shocking video of people standing on a street corner and being mowed down by bullets from a helicopter. And I didn't know what the video was, and it obviously looked like something awful. And I didn't know what WikiLeaks was or who Julian Assange was, never heard of them. And but the video stuck in my mind, and I saw it over the years, and eventually I made the time to look into this situation and learn about it, and started watching other people's documentaries. And, you know, that was 8 years after seeing the video. then at the time I was running this educational enterprise, Films for Change, we were showing other people's documentaries. It was an events business, basically. And I started watching a few documentaries on Assange and starting to make sense of it. I was still a little bit skeptical, and I was carrying all of this prejudice from mainstream news and the way that they've portrayed Julian as a villain or a criminal. But gradually I unraveled it. And at the same time, I was showing all of these various documentaries, especially in documentaries, films about animal rights and plastic in the ocean, its effect on marine life and so on. And I was starting to see how films could really drive change and affect people firsthand. And I had it in my mind to make a documentary one day, but I thought it was something that would be incredibly challenging and expensive. And so I just put that idea on the shelf. And then the pandemic came along and really uprooted our events business. We had to cancel 183 events overnight, and it just was hugely disruptive to what we were doing. And we moved to online streaming. So we have our documentary platform now, filmsforchange.stream, which is basically like a Netflix for documentaries. And we specialize in impact documentaries, especially vegan films and films around sustainability and Aboriginal, Indigenous issues and those sorts of important stuff. And, you know, so just by chance, I ended up, you know, once we got that streaming platform running smoothly, it took a few years. Then I found myself with time on my hands, no money, but time. And the idea popped back into my consciousness that I'll make a documentary. And, you know, being a beginner, never having made a documentary, I chose an easy topic, you know, Assange, politics. But, you know, I did try to make it easy for myself. It was going to be a 3-month YouTube documentary. So I didn't have to deal with licensing. I could just use other people's footage, and I could still tackle the issue and make a difference. And, you know, I set about it and bought a plane ticket down to Melbourne to interview John Shipton, Julian's father. Interview went pretty terribly. I recorded it on my mobile phone. I forgot to put it in HD.
Oh, God.
Virtually a disaster. And but funnily, you know, a tiny bit of that clip is in the actual film. It looks just slightly grainy, but it's such a good line, we just put it in anyway. Anyway, after the interview, went down on the street and asked John if we could take a photo, and got a photo with him, put it on Facebook, and it went viral. And that's what showed me that there was this tremendous interest and support and for Assange, and probably a real big calling for a new documentary on this issue.
This is the thing that kind of gets me a bit, in that there are people that care. This is a subject that is important globally. This isn't something that just concerns America, that just concerns Australia, that just concerns the UK or the Ecuadorian embassy. It's something that every single person on this planet who believes in any kind of freedom should think of an important topic. Yet we never see anything about it in the news. And the things that we did see, like you said, you had biases going into this back in 2010. The things we did see in the news were always negative, were always slanderous in nature. It's hard to think that a topic so divisive as this, when you look into the nitty-gritty details, you see that none of that slander is real. None of it stands true. Can you maybe talk to us? You mentioned this in the documentary as well. So for those who don't know, Julian Assange has been here for 7 years. I think it was in the Ecuadorian embassy. And then since 2019 has been in Belmarsh prison in the UK, despite not being charged with anything. What was the reason that he had to go into the Ecuadorian embassy?
Yeah, well, just to correct you there, that he has been charged with an 18-count indictment, which is the...
Came afterwards, though, right? That wasn't why he went into the Ecuadorian embassy.
Well, why he went into the embassy was to avoid extradition, because he already knew that the US were after him, that there was a grand jury...
indictment.
Hearing.
And, sealed.
Yeah. And why was he put into Belmarsh? Well, because, you know, for the petty crime of jumping bail, because he was in the embassy, he couldn't appear in, to check in with the police. And so they got him on that. But, you know, the normal sentence for jumping bail is 52 weeks. And here he is almost 5 years later, just being held with no date or knowledge of when he's going to be released or what's going to happen.
He went into the Ecuadorian embassy because he knew that the US indictment was coming down. It wasn't official, but, you know, for whatever reason, Julian knew that the reason that I'm being told I need to go to Sweden isn't really for the issue in Sweden. Can you maybe talk to us about that, what it is that happened there?
The Swedish thing still hangs around, and people have really a prejudice about that and leap to conclusions and perpetuate myths about that. We see it constantly on our social media. Julian Assange is a rapist. He raped two women. Excuse me. To start with, it was only an allegation. It was an allegation. It wasn't ever even, he was never charged with it. And secondly, the two women went to the police in Stockholm, Sweden, to ask the police for help because they wanted Julian Assange to take an STI test. They both slept with him on a visit to Sweden. You could say he's at fault there. He was too busy. He didn't have the consideration to do that for them. And so they went to the police to ask them to help with that. And somehow it got turned into a rape allegation and leaked to the press within 24 hours, even though that police interview is meant to be confidential. So there's all of this dodgy stuff that happened there, which is not on Julian's side. And you could make another film about that, about the Swedish debacle. And what you'll uncover is that these two women just wanted him to take an STI test. Sweden, by some kind of subterfuge or strategy, the US set this up, and they concocted this allegation, got it out onto all the front pages of the newspaper to smear him, to turn it into something that it wasn't. And then Sweden hung on to it for years and years, and they had no evidence. They just hung on to that allegation to try to get him to go to Sweden so that they could get him into custody and hand him over to the US. So it was all a plot. And eventually they just had to drop the case. There was no evidence. So these people that keep perpetuating this disgusting smear, they're such awful people that are willing to pass that around, because that's called defamation. And there's a thing called innocent until proven guilty. And anyone in this day and age can be a victim of a rumor, of an allegation. And that's what it is.
Well, this then comes on to the other big thing that people say when they talk about Julian as well. They say that he put lives at risk with the things that he had leaked through WikiLeaks. Now, the thing that they say there is he didn't redact any of the names, which would have put sources, would have put people working in intelligence services in danger. But that's also something that doesn't quite ring true, right?
Yeah, no, that's not. It's completely false. Nothing could be further from the truth. And that's a great example of projection. This is something that psychopaths do. They, whatever they're guilty of, they print it on the other side. Who's put the lives at risk? Well, the US the US led wars has resulted in millions of civilian deaths. And so these people that have this psychopathic mentality, they go, well, let's pretend that Julian put lives at risk. Then we make him look like us, and then we can use our power over the media to convince people, lazy-minded people, that oh yes, he put lives at, oh yeah, he must have put lives at risk. But the fact is, which is evidenced by Mark Davis, a lawyer and filmmaker who was with Julian right at the time that he was preparing to release the Afghan war logs. What Mark Davis is preparing to testify in US courts, if required, is that Julian Assange redacted 10,000 names. He personally did that. And his colleagues that he was collaborating with at the Guardian newspaper and other newspapers couldn't be bothered, didn't help, didn't offer to help. And the people that did release, that did leak the names in the Afghan war logs were two Guardian journalists. And I can't recall their names, but you know they published a book. You know, money grabbing sort of move to capitalize on the story, and they just carelessly printed the some sort of PIN code access code that allowed that information to get leaked. And so it was nothing to do with Assange. He went to great pains, and with the Afghan war logs, Iraq war logs, even with the diplomatic cables, if you watch the film Risk, they're actually documenting Julian calling up Hillary Clinton's office for help with redacting names, and they declined. So he went to all the efforts that he could have. He did all the due diligence, went to great efforts to redact. And on top of that, at the trial of Chelsea Manning is the leaker that from the US Army who passed on the Iraq war logs footage to WikiLeaks. And she ended up in prison for a time. Anyway, she in her trial in America, I think it was 2017, the Pentagon had to admit that there was zero evidence of anyone ever being harmed by these releases. So it's completely baseless proposition. And it continues to be perpetuated around.
This just makes me think of the big lie. The big lie of, if you tell a lie big enough and keep repeating it, people will eventually come to believe it. The lie can only be maintained for such time as the state can shield the people from the political or the military consequences of the lie. And it becomes really important then for the state to use all of its powers to repress this dissent, this truth, because that truth is the enemy of the lie. So truth is then enemy of the state, as the US has gone to show. Truth, WikiLeaks, Julian Assange has become the enemy of the state, to the point that I think WikiLeaks might be the first case of debanking that we have on a global stage, at the global level, despite the fact that there are no charges levied against WikiLeaks. The charges were against Julian. They then went after WikiLeaks directly. Now,
a first example, I'm sure there was plenty of debanking that would have happened in the past, but the first time that all of the major credit cards and PayPal and his own personal bank all coordinated to debank him. They came after him so hard in multiple ways. Just they had a whole strategy. And as we reveal in the film, there was a document we put up on the screen, the firm Stratfor that advised the US on a strategy of how to destroy WikiLeaks. And they had all of these multiple ideas. So it was a plot. It was orchestrated, and so is the narrative control, and so are the smears, and so are the perpetuation of lies by the mainstream media.
What baffles me there is what we've just said. WikiLeaks is posting the truth that goes through the due diligence of redacting names where possible, make sure vets the information that they're getting before they put it out. They're the guys that get debanked. They're the guys that are being criminalized. They're the guys that have been thrown in jail, or Julian. And yet we know that there are cartels that are banking with HSBC. We know that there are child traffickers who are able to work with banks and still clean their money and launder their money and do what they have to do. No one is going after them. We have the Epstein client logs, which for all intents and purposes are still very much hidden. No one has been charged there. We know Prince Andrew has something to do with some of this, and yet all of these people are okay. But Julian, for exposing US war crimes, it's not like he showed dirty underwear this is what Hillary likes to wear when she was working in government. War crimes. Surely war crimes should be something that citizens are supposed to know about, that their government is doing.
I said this to these couple of people on Talk TV in London the other day. I can't remember the fellow's name sitting next to me on the show, but you know, they were both basically regurgitating those smears, and you know, she tried on the he put lives at risk thing, and you know, and I said that, like, you know, let's keep in mind that that, you know, Assange and WikiLeaks were putting out the crimes. That's what the material is, and you know, that's what scared the US, and the WikiLeaks was the first media organization to really take on the mainstream for the first time. And you know, all of these problems that you just listed, Epstein and all this suppression of information, and so many different topics where we don't get all the information. And look what's going on right now with these, you know, proxy wars in Ukraine,
Israel, Gaza. Yep.
That's why we need WikiLeaks. We need the truth. We need access to real information and real data. And that's why they, you know, undermine and tried to, you know, destroy WikiLeaks, because it gets in the way of their unbridled power and their war machine.
Their monopoly on what people are led to believe is the truth. This is also something that you mentioned there, Ukraine and Gaza. It's something I often wonder if Julian Assange was still at the helm of WikiLeaks, what information would we have been made aware of by this point when it comes to those things? It does feel at times as though WikiLeaks has lost a little bit of its fangs since the removal of Julian Assange. Not to put down any of the work that WikiLeaks continues to do. It continues to operate. It's fantastic, absolutely. But when Julian was at the helm, there were these troves of documents, whether it was Vault 7 or the diplomatic cables, Cablegate, all of these things were coming out, and it seemed thick and fast at the time.
Well, there's a very good reason for that. And there's two parts to that. And one is that WikiLeaks, you know, the US, the debanking and all the dozens of court cases has just stripped them of all of their assets, and all the money that they'd raised through their successes and all their supporters has been largely had to be allocated towards the legal battle. And then the other side, as far as labor and time, is that they're devoting 99% of their resources to the campaign, rather than putting out leaks. Of course, they still get plenty of information handed to them, but they don't, you know, the priority is to get their founder out of prison.
What would you say is the impact then of this all, of the years in prison, not quite yet on Julian, but as it pertains to journalism on the whole? As you say, resources are being diverted, and unfortunately WikiLeaks was one of the only areas that we were finally getting true information from, and not regurgitated government documents handed out to the Associated Press that are then regurgitated by the BBC and the Telegraph and all the rest of them. What does this say about the state of journalism?
Well, there's not much quality journalism going on, and because of that scapegoating, that threat and that fear that any decent journalist these days would think twice. So they call that the chilling effect. But I would say it's an ice age that we're in, when you've got more than 500 journalists in prison today, right today, for their work. Assange is just one of those. Who are the other 400 or more than 500 that are sitting in prisons? We don't hear about. He's the high profile one. So, you know, journalists are scared. And the ironic thing is that, you know, so few journalists have been willing to stick up for Julian. Most of them have been happy to sort of criticize him and perpetuate these myths, these smears. But they should be sticking up with for him because he brought so much integrity to the journalistic profession. And so it just, it's baffling that they are not 100% all united to campaign for his freedom. Occasionally you see letters, joint letters by, you know, some of the top newspapers, but they don't do enough. And then ironically, you have this, with this sort of technocratic takeover that's going on around the world, pushing all of these technological developments upon us, AI is taking over the job of the hack journalist. So anyone that's just, you know, all they've done is spin out government handouts is now being in the process of being replaced by AI. So I would feel sorry for them if they weren't so useless on helping with causes like important causes like this. So, you know, if you want to retain your journalistic profession, you better start looking for some decent information and having the courage to speak out on important issues.
We've spoken about
you. No, having said that, I don't blame people for being afraid to put out, you know, to publish leaks and stuff, that you really have to have some courage. You have to believe in the importance of that information getting out. And that's what's so admirable about Assange, WikiLeaks, you know, all the journalists that were involved with all of their big releases. They all have a lot of guts. Like, you know, I'm really impressed with Kristen Hrafnsson, who joined WikiLeaks. You know, he was the one that went to one of him and his colleague went to Iraq to just a few days before they released the collateral murder video to do some due diligence and check, verify the authenticity of it. You know, it takes so much courage for people to be a meaningful journalist.
Absolutely. And you mentioned there, it takes courage to do these things. You know, for the guys you just mentioned, it's the courage to step into a war zone. But there are a couple people that have been whistleblowers, well, many people that have been whistleblowers, that have really felt the full wrath. Now, Chelsea Manning being one of them, serving some time. Someone else I've had on the podcast, John Kiriakou, the person who blew the whistle on the American torture program and actually let us know that the rumor of American prisoners of war being tortured by the CIA was a real thing. It wasn't a rumor and it was state sanctioned. And then there's Daniel Ellsberg, who you interviewed within the documentary, The Leaker of the Pentagon Papers. Why is it that relative to the absolute insanity that is happening, the absolute outrageous acts that these governments are putting out there, why is it that there are so few whistleblowers? What is it stopping people?
Well, because it's just more comfortable to sort of stay under the radar and just follow convention and follow the crowd and don't stick your neck out.
What happens when they stick their neck out?
Most people do that. If you stick your neck out, you lose your job, or you get threatened, or you get harassed, or you know, you have death threats, or you get debanked, or you know, all the stuff that they've done to whistleblowers and their publishers can happen to you. What we really need to do is to create enough awareness through something, you know, through this film and other means, so that the public can get behind and support whistleblowers and stick up for them. And that, you know, that's the message of the film, is that we are the ones who are meant to be saving Julian Assange. And if we had a culture in the world where, you know, in our societies where whistleblowers are celebrated, protected, endorsed, encouraged, and that's what WikiLeaks was doing, to protect whistleblowers by anonymity, then, you know, we could just have a truthful world. It's a vision. You know, that was the vision of WikiLeaks. It was a noble, beautiful vision of that, we could create a new world informed by the leaks of the previous world of corruption, as Naraj says in the film. It's a beautiful vision. That's something that I really wanted to share with people, is that, no, Assange is not a dodgy, sneaky, you know, anything else. He's not a criminal or a traitor. He is a patriot of a better, peaceful world, a world without wars. The traitors to humanity, as I say in the narration at the end, those that are, persecuting Julian, are committing espionage against humanity. Never mind about this bogus 1917 Espionage Act they're using against an American law against an Australian citizen. I mean, it's laughable if it wasn't so scary what they're trying to do. But who's doing the espionage to a peaceful world? It's these people that are going after a journalist for exposing their own crimes.
I was going to ask you why people should care, but I think you've put it quite nicely there. People should care so that we have that transparency and that honesty from our government. And yeah, you're right. Who is conducting the espionage? Well, as we saw from the WikiLeaks files on Vault 7, as you guys mentioned, the US government is actively on every piece of electronic equipment that you have, whether it's your TV or your fridge or anything else that can connect to the internet. The US government have ways of getting in through the back door so they can do and listen to everything that you have. And
Russia, right?
No, exactly. In fact, that was one of the things that they tried to do. I think it was with Cablegate. They tried to say that was a Russian leak, and the Russians had to say, sorry, lads, we've got nothing to do with this. This wasn't us that gave this information to WikiLeaks. As you mentioned earlier, they always try to project it onto anyone else that's not going to be the government. It's a bit of a glaring indictment then on our society as a whole and on our democracy. If someone who is speaking truth to power, in essence, has been locked up for so long on foreign laws for a crime that was never committed, because that's, what is it about the Espionage Act that they're actually charging him with here? An act from over 100 years ago, as you rightly pointed out.
Yeah, well, it's basically like it's 18 counts, 17 counts of espionage, like as if he's against America. And then the one charge of computer intrusion, claiming that he helped Chelsea Manning hack into the US computers, although Manning has straight out said, no, I had access. I didn't need any help. I just could get in anytime I want. It's all bogus. How can a journalist be guilty of espionage? It's an unprecedented thing. It's absolutely shocking and horrid. And it's so, murderous and violent what they're doing to this man. Let me just give this little anecdote. When I was, researching the free speech history for that little brief thing in the middle, there's a longer version, which I'll put out sometime in the future, a longer animation. But we did a short version in the middle of the film where we just say, how did we get to this point? Are our rights to free speech eroding, developing, or are they eroding? And then we do this quick whiz through history. And one of the characters I came across in this research, looking up some of the significant figures throughout this battle for our free speech, for our rights. Let me preface it with this interesting sort of theory or discovery of mine through that research, was that there was a time when we had unbridled free speech, because in the Stone Age, we lived in small little family units, and really the worst that anyone could do if you said something wrong was maybe bang you on the head with a bone or something, right? So there's no big power structure over the top of you. There's no big society saying, here are the laws, we're going to put you in prison. It's just between you and your little community. And so we must have had incredible amounts of free speech at that time to express ourselves. And then as societies developed, as you had ancient Egypt and Mesopotamia and all these big societies that came during the Bronze Age, that's when we started to have, you know, the people on top saying, you know, how dare you? I am the noble ruler. I'm the worthy one. You know, when it's Egypt, they thought that they were gods. So how dare you say anything against me? And that's where it all began. And then since that time, for 5,000 years, we've been trying to get some rights back. So it's not that, you know, we never had them. We're just trying to get them back. So that's an interesting thing that I sort of came across through that research, that realization that it's a process of reclaiming our rights. But now we have them eroding again in the last 10, 20, 30 years. It's getting worse because of the persecution of journalists. But anyway, back to the anecdote I wanted to share. So 400 years ago in London, there was an underground printer. His name was William Anderton. And he was printing pamphlets, probably by candlelight, secretly at night in some kind of dingy little printing room. So his pamphlets were calling for the return of the ousted kings, like big deal. You know, we don't like the current kings. Let's bring back the other kings.
The old ones, yeah.
When they found out about what he was doing, they took him to the town square, cut him in half and hung him and then dragged him down the road. And he was tried at the court of the Old Bailey courthouse. Now, 400 years later, you have an underground printer putting out information, which is more hectic information, granted. And his name was Assange, and his group was WikiLeaks, and they tried him in the Old Bailey, and they did the same methods to that they used on Anderton. They rigged the jury, they ignored the evidence. He's been charged on these indictment under the Espionage Act. But the only difference is nowadays it's unacceptable to hang somebody in the town square and chop their body in half and drag them down the road. We see that as barbaric. But the way that they're murdering Julian Assange is by keeping him in solitary confinement 22 hours a day for nearly 5 years. Anyone is going to develop health problems. And what they're hoping is he just has a heart attack and passes away or gets murdered or something like that or kills himself. Then they don't have to, you know, deal with WikiLeaks anymore. So it's a slow motion execution behind doors, William Anderton style, but in the modern age.
Freedom isn't free. And I think this really goes to show that, like you say, people can't be hung, drawn and quartered anymore, not like they used to be in the town square. So the way they do it is behind closed doors where people don't realize it. And this is where I think there's some kind of apathy towards this case from a large portion of the public, where they just don't realize that importance of those freedoms that, like you say, realistically, we're trying to get back those freedoms that are eroding day by day. Here in Europe, as you're here now with us, we've got essentially a UK equivalent of the Online Safety Bill, where everything's going to be tracked and end-to-end encryption essentially will be no more. There's no privacy. And when the citizenry has no privacy from its government, they're under a tyranny. When the government has no privacy from the citizenry, that's where we have more freedoms. That's where we have more possibilities and more capabilities. But just coming back to Assange, you mentioned his health there. There's some really scary things happening with him right now, eh? He's had a stroke not too long ago, and his health isn't getting any better. As you mentioned, he's been in solitary for 22 hours a day. And in the prison that he's in, Belmarsh Prison, the hardest prison in the UK, it's the prison that they send terrorists to and whatnot, you know, murderers, the vilest criminals that we have. 25% of those prisoners have said that they're scared for their own safety. And a journalist has been thrown in there amongst those kinds of people. And he's been kept in isolation, even worse. The psychological torture that that must be inflicting on him, as you guys have in the documentary. Nils Meltzer, the special UN special rapporteur for torture at the time, has gone in and said, no, he's showing clear signs via the globally, internationally recognized Istanbul Protocol. What is this slow death that you mentioned? What is it that's happening to him in prison there? That is this, we're killing him, but we're not killing him kind of thing that's happening.
Well, they definitely are killing him, and the apathy and ignorance of the people is killing him. Doctors for Assange is a group that's advocating for his health, and Jill Stein said in her interview that psychological stress predisposes somebody to cardiovascular issues, heart attacks and strokes. So, you know, we can all have stressful daily lives, but imagine if you have, like, if you've ever experienced really extreme stress for a short amount of time and how unwell it makes you feel. You can literally just become, you feel really sick within just a 5 minutes or a few hours, your stomach gets sick. Imagine going through that for years and years and years, all the stress of having your reputation defamed with lies, with people saying that you're a rapist, with people saying that you're a criminal, you're a traitor, being debanked, having the threat of execution in the US or a life prison sentence, which is the same thing, being separated from your family, from your children that are growing up without you there, being isolated from society in general, being kept in a 6 meter square cell. You just can't imagine it. I mean, look at the lockdowns. You know, it was tough for people to have a 2 week lockdown when you're just at home with all the comforts, with your Netflix, and you could even get pizza delivered and stuff. Imagine being in lockdown for nearly 7 years when he was in the embassy. And then the space gets even more confined. You get carted off to the worst prison, as you say, in the UK, which is just unimaginable unpleasantness on a 24 hours a day. So what that's going to do to your body is slowly just destroy you. It's a miracle that he's lasted this long. That's a testament to his resilience, his will to live, his will to win, to not let them kill him. But having said that, not surprisingly, he's suicidal at times. He's depressed. They found a razor blade in his prison cell. He does have bouts of depression, not surprising at all. But also, he doesn't want to be in the hands of his tormentors in the US, where they will torture him to get information out of him. And he could actually be executed. They could upgrade his sentence in the US, because the US just do whatever they want. Yeah. That's what we let them do. And, you know, going back to what you said about people's
apathy,
lack of understanding of this, you know, what that really stems from at the base of it is the society we live in, the way it's structured, where you know, the elite at the top have a monopoly of everything. And I'm not a socialist. Don't anyone think I'm a Marxist or something, you know. You know, capitalism has its benefits, and so do other systems. There's no perfect system. The only perfect system is let's all be loving and peaceful and not greedy.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I'll hardly agree on that one.
Anyway, I've lost my train of thought now, but the system, right? So, you know, because we're oppressed by, you know, the structure of modern society, where even though there's all these technological developments and you know, we should be working less and being wealthier and living in a sustainable world. We don't, because the world is so corrupt. And because of that, most of us have to work 40 hours a day and we're exhausted. And when we get home, we're tired. We don't want to learn about Julian Assange or look at politics. We just want to watch some fantasy Dune 2 movie. You know, I like movies just like anyone else. And, you know, and I've never been one for political documentaries. And, you know, I've only watched a few in my life. I'm not into politics. I'd much rather watch fun stuff and go surfing and, you know, play music and just take it easy. But we have to have some engagement with politics because we live in a broken world. And people need to realize that if we don't allocate a little bit of time to finding out what's going on in the world and getting involved with issues, even if in the smallest way, just 5 minutes a day, you know, sign a petition, read about something and post about it, share it around. If we don't do that, these corrupt, crooked people will just have unbridled power. And all of this stuff continues, all of these wars and all of this corruption, and it will just go on. You know, I'm sure, you know, with your work, you've chosen to do podcasts and tackle complicated issues, and I've been privileged. You know, I've chosen it as well. I've chosen making a difference in the world over some career that just gives you plenty of income. I've chosen to do things that gets me out of bed in the morning and makes me feel like I'm making a difference.
Gives you purpose. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's given me an opportunity to learn a lot. So I'm sort of partly privileged by that, but it's also a conscious choice. I decided to get involved and do things, you know, voluntarily and put on events where it was free entry and we made nothing or we lost money, you know, because I do care about the world. And so we all need to care about the world, not just our family and friends. And for goodness sake, you know, don't care about how good you look and how, you know, are you wearing the latest fashion label and, you know, does your grass look as good as your neighbor's? Like, get away from all this superficial stuff, because that's what perpetuates all the
power at the top,
inequity in the world.
Yeah. I think you're bang on the money there with that 40-hour work week, keeping people's nose to the grindstone. As you mentioned, the power of the elite at the top with things like the incoming carbon taxes and those sorts of things that are only going to rob the middle class and create a huge disparity between the haves and the have-nots. And the people that currently have it okay are really going to go down towards that have-not territory. And it's only going to get harder and harder for people to acknowledge what's happening around them. As a kid, when my dad used to tell me to keep an eye on the news, see what's going on around you, I used to ignore him and think, it doesn't bother me. It doesn't matter to me. Yeah, what does it matter who's in power or that, or this, that, or the rest of it? Now, as I've grown up, I've realized politics is either something that happens to you or you get involved and try and make something happen for you. It really is that simple. More and more people need to get involved. And my day job is in healthcare. I see, you know, 100 odd people a week. And I feel sorry for them at times because politics, you know, geopolitics, it's one of my favorite topics because I spend every free moment that I have, you know, that I'm not with my little one or with my wife or working, I spend every free moment trying to look up things like this, trying to learn as much as I can, because there's three sides to every story. There's your side, my side, and the truth. The truth is usually somewhere in the middle. And now we're not even getting so much of anything to be able to make that truth from mainstream outlets. Even some of the mainstream alternative outlets are putting a massive spin on things. So it really is a case of just having to dig in and look into things, figure out what's going on. Over the last few years with COVID, the abhorrent things that happened there, the fact that there was this global conspiracy to do all of these things at the same time across every country. We've had, what's the country?
Sweden?
No, not Sweden. Belarusia. The Belarusian president has come out and said the IMF offered him money to impose the lockdowns and essentially were giving him a bribe and said, we'll give you, was it 93 billion or something, if you do these things, if you impose lockdowns, impose mask mandates and the rest of it. We know hospitals were given bonuses per patient that they threw on a COVID register. It's insane to think all these things are happening. And we go back to what I said at the beginning of the big lie. If you repeat these things often enough, people are just going to buy it, because it's far easier to buy into the lie than it is and sit at home and watch your Netflix, eat your popcorn, et cetera, than it is to realize there's a few things going on here. There's a reason my wage isn't going to the end of the month like it used to. And this is one of the biggest things for me. If journalists don't have the option to anymore, which if we look at France and we look at Canada, in France, if you go against the health, what the government says is the health protocol, you get 3 years in prison. In Canada, anything that they deem hate speech isn't defined, you can get life in prison. More and more, those freedoms are eroding, as you say. We've had Navalny die in prison not 1 week ago. There's something else that I wanted to bring up to you, but I know we're running short on time. I fear that, you know, as you say, they're hoping that the same thing happens to Julian as well. These are two people that really spoke truth to power. Do you see many parallels between the two men there who, in my opinion at least, were looking to make the world a bit of a better place, hoping for things to move in that right direction? Like I said, when I was going to ask you why the public should care about this, you said it was about truth, honesty, transparency, so that we can have a better life for everybody.
Yeah, there's really clear parallels there with Navalny and Assange and so many other figures. But, Assange and WikiLeaks did something so hugely significant, and he's been so violently pursued that, and I think they haven't done away with him in a quick way, because there is still an issue of, it's in the actual Stratfor documents that he could become a martyr in prison. And so I think what they're hoping for is that his story just fades away little by little, people forget about him, but that's not going to happen. So they've really got a problem on their hands, because the awareness is growing, the movement is growing, people's understanding is growing, and they're in a pickle. So the best thing they can do at this point is actually free him, do their best to protect their crimes and hide their crimes better, because the people are uniting on this, and I think we're going to win it in the end. And I think when Assange is freed, I'm not sure how long it will take, but when it happens, it will be a turning point towards a more just, peaceful, truthful world. It's such an important battle that we have to win. And, you know, by doing that, we protect other journalists and we protect other whistleblowers, and we look after our rights and our future generations. It's such an important battle to win.
You mentioned there the Stratfor document and the fact that this was planned out. This was game planned, what they wanted to do, how they wanted to bankrupt the man, how they wanted to drain any funds that he did have to be able to push and pursue and do anything in reality. It raises the question, why hasn't the UK just given in? I mean, Priti Patel has already tried to just kick him out, right? The lovely Home Secretary that we have had there, that she is. She's already tried to give the okay for the extradition. The fact that we're now 2 weeks on, yesterday, even 2 weeks on from the 21st of Feb, which was where Julian's defense team was putting on the defense, and then the American prosecution put on the prosecution for the extradition, and we still have no answers. It raises a lot of questions as what is the holdup? Is there anything that you might be able to provide?
No, we can only theorize about that. And One theory is that they might, they just generally take their time on everything. Everything's been done as slow as possible, probably because of this strategy of, you know, the longer things drag out and the more kind of, you know, nothing is happening, the less interest that there is, the less media. If everything, there's just not much happening, and if the Assange campaign have to work hard to generate some kind of story for the media to do, that's what, you know, drags it out and reduces the visibility of the issue. Another theory is that the US, the Democrats don't really want that court action to start leading up to the election, because it makes them look bad and it's negative publicity. So it won't help Biden get back into power. And so they might allow the appeal. So everything's just been dragged out. But also that's another method of psychological torture for him and his family.
The waiting, the not knowing.
Just have that not knowingness. I mean, you know, just the fact that he's in prison with no release date, no future. His future is not his own. His body is not his own. That's a really serious form of torture in itself. Even if you are a violent criminal, a murderer, you know how long your sentence is.
Well, that's one of the things that they did, right? They stripped him naked and threw him in isolation when, was it Preeti announced the extradition should have been happening. And that is another form of torture. At every stage, the government's done everything they can. And, you know, in that sense of the government hoping things slow down, I really hope that your documentary brings more, as you're doing, just brings way more attention to it. You know, you mentioned before we kicked off, they want the collateral murder video to go away. And you guys have that video in its entirety on the documentary. And it's a hard watch, especially when you see the other interview that you guys popped in there. Could you maybe very briefly talk to us about collateral murder? And then the interview that you guys showed in it afterwards of the young child, and then where people can find out more about your work, where they can find the documentary, and yeah, because I know you got to shoot soon as well.
Yeah, well, we wanted to include the collateral murder video mainly for people that have never seen it, which is the majority of people, even all these years later. Not enough people have seen that video, and it's such an important video to see. And then we substantiate it with commentary from some experts, including Dean Yates, who was the Reuters chief of staff in Baghdad at the time. So he's the best person on the scene that actually investigated it firstly. And then it was Chelsea Manning who later released it about 3 years later, and then WikiLeaks that published it. But then also we include this harrowing, disturbing and sad video, never seen before video of an interview with a child victim of the collateral murder incident, Syed Mutashar, who was on that day, his father had picked up him and his sister from the mosque where they were having lessons, so essentially from school. And they're driving down the road and they get to the scene of this disgusting atrocity is a good word, where, you know, civilians, including two Reuters journalists holding cameras in their hands, have been mowed down dead, and one fellow is on the ground in his own blood crawling around. They drive up to the scene and pull over to help, which is a brave thing to do when you're in New Baghdad at that time, in a wartime.
And 2007, right? This happened.
Correct. Yeah. 2007, and so they try to help, and then the Apache starts shooting the van, which is, it's just the most blatant example of a war crime.
While they laugh about it, mind you.
Yeah, well, that's the other side of the manner in the commentary on the video is so putrid. So the two children only survive because their father throws his body over the top of them while there's raining bullets. It's just so awful. You can't even come to terms with it. And then, so that interview was with the boy whose father's been killed by this attack, and he is he has scars that he shows. And you know, we put that in there because you know, to show the human side of that incident. The US want that incident swept under the carpet and forgotten about, and we're going to bring it back, dredge it out from the archives and show the whole story and show it to a new audience that weren't aware of it, and put it back into the public consciousness so that it can be properly addressed. Syed Mutashar is no longer with us. He was sadly killed in a car bomb attack about 3 years ago. So he never got to see justice for what happened to him. You know, these people deserve justice, and that's what Assange and WikiLeaks were trying to bring about. So we really need to look into this, bring it into our awareness, take some time to see how Assange has suffered, what he was trying to do with his efforts, and how all of this affects all of us, all of our rights and the rights of future generations.
And where can people watch the documentary? How can people find out more about what you guys are doing? As I think, well, it's important everyone watches this.
Yeah, thank you. It's in cinemas in Australia, New Zealand. It's been out for a couple of nearly 2 months now, and it just keeps growing and building. It's been, you know, the reception from it, from the cinemas that are booking it in, has way surpassed our expectations. We have all the three major cinema chains in Australia are showing the film right now. Like it basically started in the biggest chain last night. So we had thousands of people watching it in a cinema, in the ultimate environment where it can have the most impact. So the reception's been mind-blowing. The support from Assange supporters, from freedom fighters, from just people that want peace in the world. You know, we don't all have to agree on every view, but if we can all agree that free speech and world peace are important, then we can, you know, embrace a film like this. And this has happened. I pinch myself every day looking at these cinema homepages with our film up there amongst all of these huge
Hollywood blockbusters.
Yeah, right. It's right in amongst those, and it's getting more shares and more traction. So just really happy with the response. It's releasing in UK cinemas 15th of March, so that's only 9 days.
Yeah.
Again, it's going to be a slow, gradual building release. I think within a month or two, you probably have 100 cinemas. So, you know, people have to be patient. If you're in the UK, you know, wherever you are in Australia, New Zealand, UK, if it's not in a cinema near you, just go and suggest it to the cinema. That really helps. We've had a lot of cinemas literally come to us and say, three people asked for this film, so we're going to show it.
Fucking A.
Yeah. That's all it can take sometimes, because they don't get that with the Hollywood films.
No.
They get it with something interesting like this. So, yeah, really helpful if people suggest it to their local cinema. Go to our website, thetrustful.org, for upcoming screenings to find your nearest session. And we have a strategy. We have a distributor. We have, you know, a plan to get it out. We can't just bung it up on YouTube, because we have like a dozen investors already that have to get their money back. And they've been so generous to make that loan that we can put it out as if it was a blockbuster. We can advertise. So, you know, we do have a certain strategy to it. But that said, imagine if one of the largest cinema chains in Europe or America puts it into 1,000 cinemas with 10 screenings. Overnight, you can reach a million people very quickly with the most powerful experience. So it's a bit of a myth that, you know, putting it up on digital is the quickest way to spread it. You know, cinemas can also do an excellent job. And more importantly, you have that live audience, you have the attention that you give when you're in a cinema. It's more impactful. So it's a very meaningful way for us to release the film. We don't have the option to just put it out digitally. It will go out digitally eventually once it finishes this spectacular cinema run. And, you know, we have the aim to reach a million people in Australia in the cinema over the next couple of months to inform a million people on this, and a million, maybe 10 million in America, or maybe 50 million. We're very ambitious with it. We've got supporters, investors to help make it happen. So it's an incredible time for building awareness. And the other side benefit that I want to mention is that thanks to our investors, we are currently reaching 1.5 million people per week with the trailer. Wow. On Facebook. And that's an amazing spin-off benefit. You know, that's 3 minutes of information to 1.5 million every week, introducing people to this idea, to this situation. They get a quick insight into what's going on with Assange. And so that's, you know, almost as powerful as the thousands of people coming in and seeing it in a cinema.
Are there any plans to do a European mainland distribution as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're going to take it to every country. We're going to translate it to Japanese and Swahili and everything. Nice. Yeah, we will take it everywhere. There's people willing to translate, to volunteer their time to do translations, and that's all it takes, and we can put it out. You know, as you said right at the beginning, this is a issue that affects the whole world, and that's because WikiLeaks put out 10 million documents basically every country of the world. America was one of the last countries that they exposed. Before that, they'd basically covered every country, whatever crimes and corruption existed. So he has fans everywhere, supporters everywhere, and he's helped many, many people in many countries. And so, you know, in every corner of the globe, there's people that support Assange and people that also need to find out more about it.
Well, look, Kim, I think everyone listening needs to see this documentary. Whether you think you know enough about the Assange case or not, it's mind-blowing, the depth that you guys go into, the information that you guys get into in this documentary. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you for everything you're doing for this. How can people find you, find out a little bit more about what you guys are doing, or any more information around the case? And have you got any last bits that you'd like to impart on the listeners as well?
Yeah, sure. Well, thanks for your support, Sonny. Appreciate it, and your endorsement. The website is thetrustfall.org. You can find screenings there. You can contribute something to our crowdfunding. You can contact me through that website if you want to invest, if you want to really get involved with this project in a big way. Our social media, of course, we're on all the main platforms. Haven't been censored yet, strangely, not even really shadow banned. It's a bit miraculous.
I got shadow banned sharing this, that I was going to be speaking to you. I think I reached 30 people. It was really weird.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, well, I don't know what's going on there, but yeah, our socials are very busy, and, you know, we're sharing news about the film. I just urge people to, as I said earlier, you know, take the time. It's worth it. You know, watch one less fictional movie and watch this documentary. I can guarantee you won't be bored. This is not a boring, political, cold, dry film. We didn't make it that way. We put art, we put feeling and expression and even some poetry into it. It's a tragic, sad watch, but it's not lacking in humor, and you won't finish the film in a pool of your own tears. We'll pick you up at the end and you know, share some inspiration of what we could do, what we could, if we combine our efforts, what we could achieve towards a better world.